It is the Good Food Hour on KSRO. In the KSRO kitchen this morning, I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash, celebrating our 34th year in the kitchen, and we got to clean this thing.
We have to what?
Clean this thing.
Okay.
34 years.
I know.
My gosh. So what are you going to
do? Are we making a lot of money?
We're making tons of money. It's funny. Every Mother's Day for the last 30 plus years, we talk about Mother's Day a little bit, and I can't not recall every Mother's Day you would go, it was the worst day at the restaurant.
Yes, at the restaurant.
It was what every cook, yeah, what every chef, like, okay, I got to get ready,
yeah,
to pump out like 200, 300, 400 Eggs Benedict?
Eggs Benedict, or some variation on the Eggs Benedict. And the other kind, and this is kind of the sad part of it, is that often, I mean, most people get along with their mom and they enjoy them and stuff, but some don't. And so they feel this obligatory, I have to take mom out. And so they take them out for Mother's Day brunch someplace, and they're not getting along, and there's lots of tension at the table. And the poor waiters have to kind of, you know, they're trying to get everybody to have a good time and make sure that mom has a good time.
Well, that's why you need to get mom that, and son or daughter-in-law, whatever it is,
yeah,
a few champagne cocktails.
That's right.
Right away.
That's right. Hi, Mom. Do you want another mimosa?
Exactly. Yeah. Flyer with many mimosas. But most of us, I think, are looking forward to Mother's Day, even though it's going to be unlike any Mother's Day any of us have probably ever had.
Yeah. It's interesting, this takeout thing that a lot of restaurants are doing there. I noticed that a lot are offering Mother's Day menus. But I don't know.
We'll see. I applaud
them. I mean, I hope it works.
I do, too. And I notice that even John Ash & Company is doing a Mother's Day dinner, which is exciting. This is the first time the kitchen's reopened, I think, since the closing.
Basically, yeah.
So Tom's...
For takeout.
For takeout, yeah. He's doing a three-course meal to choose from. Pick up curbside at John Ash. And you have a choice menu for two. There's two menus if you go online.
Yeah.
One with... a Zinfandel braised short rib entree, and then a Tom's chicken cordon bleu, along with all the trimmings and tiramisu. So that's nice that restaurants are doing this.
Yeah. I have to say, though, that this is, and I know a number of food types have kind of commented on it, that one of the good things, the little silver lining in all of this, is that people are cooking themselves. You know, they're doing things, and so this might be something you can do for mom, is cook her something that she really loves.
And from 2015, when we did Mother's Day on the show, you did a Mother's Day 2015 menu. And we're going to go over a few of those that people might want to tackle tomorrow.
Oh, they can do them all.
They can actually do this.
Do the whole thing.
Not that onerous at all.
Get started right
so
now.
So when did Mother's Day actually start?
So I looked this up because I thought, well, what is Mother's Day? And basically, it's not that old. It is one of those things that started back in 1914. A woman named Anna Jarvis sort of helped put it on the map. And what she was doing was really trying to honor moms. And then later in life, she tried desperately to get it over with, because it had been co-opted by florists and card companies and all of that kind of stuff. But it was really interesting. But then in way before that, there was a time in Greek history in which there was also a kind of Mothering Day, which was also to honor moms because of the good work that they did with children and all of that stuff. But you have to look it up to see this, that... Anna Reeves Jarvis and Julia Ward Howe were the two ladies who did this. But then this little headline in this piece that I had is that she decried the commercialization of Mother's Day. And I guess you could probably say that about every holiday.
Yeah. But those wonderful cards that moms and grandmas put away when their children were 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12. Those are some of the most important and meaningful keepsakes.
Well, it's true. The ones that got stuck up on the refrigerator door.
You bet. So the Mother's Day 2015 menu that you put together, which it doesn't require a lot of skill to put together, which is the braised chicken thighs with lemon and green olives. Not anything exotic in this particular recipe at all.
Yeah.
How does this go together?
I sent you another one too, another menu that I found that I did.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, here I'll
see that
here.
One.
You can take a look at this.
Oh, look at this.
So it's a little more elaborate, but maybe a little more motherly, I guess.
Well, certainly buttermilk cinnamon coffee cake. Pretty easy to make, isn't it?
It's fantastic.
But you have to have buttermilk.
It's actually a recipe that's been around for a long time, and I think I first found it in the Café Beaujolais breakfast book or something, and this is my variation on that theme.
And the only thing that you might not be able to get a hold of, well, buttermilk, I think most people can grab a quart of buttermilk at a store.
Oh, yeah. So the difference, though, is, can we talk about buttermilk for a second? Really good buttermilk if you've never had it. And we're just talking to Gwen about how old we are and all of that, and the people that she doesn't remember that are central to our lives and things like that. But real buttermilk is just a different animal than the stuff we get in the store, which is cultured milk. So it has a culture thrown into it, which is what thickens it up. But when you get real buttermilk after churning cream and then the bit of milk, really, because all of the fat has been turned into butter, or most of it, it's so delicious, and it's kind of sour, and has a little flecks of butter in it, and it's really delicious.
Well, that's the best, but most people are not going to be able to get a hold of that.
Well, you can get some heavy cream and do it. I was going to give you for Christmas. Actually, there's a company called the Kilner Company. I think they're in Scotland. And they sell now a little butter churner. You just take good heavy cream. especially, you have to make sure it's not the ultra-pasteurized kind, but just regular good old-fashioned heavy cream, and put it in there, and you just crank this sucker, and it's amazing. In about 4 or 5 minutes, you get butter.
Do you have one?
Yeah.
And it works?
It works. If you're a good boy.
I'd like it. Yeah. Okay, you heard it on the show today, folks. I'm going to be looking December 25th to make sure I get that. So buttermilk cinnamon coffee cake, that's a no-brainer for Mom.
Yeah,
Hi, look at this. My grandmother's cheese blintzes. Did she make cheese blintzes?
And so these are blintzes that are made making a crepe first, which, interestingly, you can make ahead of time. Crepes are just really thin pancakes. And then she would just fill it with a really simple mixture of farmer's cheese and fruits and things like that, and then do a little fruit sauce on top of it. And you can make those ahead. And traditionally, how they're served is you fold them up into little envelopes. And then when you're ready to serve them, have some butter in a pan, and you saute them until they get lightly browned and warm through, and put some kind of fresh fruit sauce on top.
Boy, this is actually very simple to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you say the name crepes and everybody, I can't make crepes.
Well, everything can be made ahead, with the exception of the sauteing of them, so you can even make them a day ahead.
The cheese filling can be made today pretty easily, little ricotta.
Right. Yeah, ricotta or farmer's cheese or something. Yeah.
And the toppings, whatever you have around, but maybe if it's just powdered sugar.
Powdered sugar would be great, but we have a lot of fresh strawberries right now, so just chop some up and heat them up with a little sugar, a squeeze of lemon. And
I'm going back between both of these recipes. I love the grapefruit and savory green salad with goat cheese.
Yeah.
Or even mandarin oranges. There's still some really good citrus in. So that's a lovely salad dish. And then for main courses, besides blintzes, you have a green chili and chorizo strata.
Stratas are one of those things everybody should know how to make. It's basically a bread pudding. But you just take bread, tear it up, throw it in a pan, and then you can layer anything in there that you want. And this particular one uses green chilies and chorizo. And pour a egg custard over the top of it. Ideally, do it the night before so that the bread has a chance to really suck up all of the custard, and then bake it in the morning.
That's not hard.
No. It's not supposed to be hard.
So those are a couple quick and easy
dishes. Do you think everything I do is chefy and hard?
No, actually, that's the beauty of your cuisine, isn't it? Yeah. It's not. Slow-cooked eggs with herb salad and creme fraiche. Difficult?
No.
Not really.
No.
But the slow-cooked eggs.
So if you've never used the oven?
I haven't looked at the recipe.
Slow-cooked eggs. They're basically scrambled, And Julia talked about them. I remember seeing her do it one time, and I couldn't believe it. She took about 10 minutes to scramble a bunch of eggs. So she took them, beat them up with a little bit of cream or creme fraiche, and then put them in a pan, and over the lowest possible heat, she even recommended doing it over a double boiler that was barely simmering. You just slowly stirred them and stirred them and stirred them. And instead of eggs are very, it's a protein that it freezes very quickly, which means it hardens very quickly. But by cooking them at this really slow rate, they turn into, and this is her word, her description, creamy curds of delicious egg.
Simple.
Was that good?
I closed my eyes and I thought it was, Julia. So that's a very easy dish to make. And then dessert. Now, a lot of folks are challenged as far as getting flour. We know that.
Yeah.
And you came up with a solution. Flourless chocolate souffle.
Yeah.
What could be really easy?
And what's really cool about this one is you can make it ahead of time and then put it back in the oven.
Oh.
So you can even bake it ahead of time.
How far ahead of time?
Oh, you know, a couple hours.
You can?
Yeah, so you have it. And it doesn't rise up quite as high, but it rises back up. There's still some air captured in there, so it's kind of fun.
Wow.
And even if it doesn't, you don't want to hear this story again. But I'm going to tell you anyway. I was helping Julia on a show that she was doing on souffles, you know. And she was making savory souffles and sweet souffles and all of that stuff. And she did the chocolate souffle. And so it was the whole thing where she was showing you how to mix up the egg whites and the chocolate and all of that stuff. And then had one just coming out of the oven. And I remember she opened the door, pulled it out. It was beautiful. It was, you know, an inch or so above the edge of the dish. Pulled it out of the oven, took it to the table to serve it up. And you could just watch it deflate down below the edge of the plate. And without missing a beat, she said, well, we'll call it the fallen souffle cake.
The know, master.
Which became a standard on restaurant menus, certainly through the 80s and on that stuff before the molten chocolate cake hit. But it was great. And really what it was a souffle that didn't rise. So if your souffle doesn't rise, may your souffle rise. If it doesn't rise, it becomes the fallen souffle cake.
So if you're down to your last scoop of all-purpose flour or you want to go gluten-free, there's all these wonderful desserts that mom would love, including John's flourless chocolate souffle. You can make a tiramisu, right?
Yeah.
No flour. You can make a flan.
Panna cotta.
You can make a panna cotta. You can make a mousse.
Yeah.
There's so many things that are delicious desserts, especially with the temperatures being
in
the 70s.
You know, and one of the things right now, because actually berries are pretty good in the market right now, to make a trifle. You know, just layer whipped cream and whipped creme fraiche and fruits that have been macerated in a little bit of sugar and layer those in a beautiful bowl and let it sit for a while. And there you go.
And then the ridiculously easy mocha pot au creme, which has been a Garner household staple for probably 45 years. And the great thing about this is it's so fast. It's basically semi-sweet chocolate, some sugar, a little coffee powder, an egg, vanilla, a little bit of coffee, some half and half or cream. You put it all in a blender. This is really how it's done. You add the warm cream, the hot cream, blend it for a couple minutes, pour it into little demitasse cups or custard cups, and refrigerate it for 3-4 hours.
So no cooking.
No really? Cooking.
Yeah.
Except for heating
fantastic.
The cream. And it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, come on, don't tell me there's anyone out there in Radioland that can't do that.
They can. You just need a blender.
You just need a blender. All right. I think what we'll try to do, John, is post your Culinary Mother's Day class from 2009, that menu, and the one from 2015, so people can look at that this afternoon.
Sure.
How about that?
Yeah, that's good.
All right.
Because it doesn't just have to be for Mother's Day. You can make those things any time.
Father's Day too.
Father's Day.
Oh, sure. Just around the corner.
They're just forgotten about.
So we'll take a break, and we'll come back, and I believe we're going to taste a little cheese before we join Chris Kimball, the founder of Cook's Illustrated Magazine, America's Test Kitchen, and his newest venture, Milk Street.
Yeah, that guy's a genius.
He's a genius, and we love Chris because he's so opinionated. And
that's
perfect
true.
For radio has the experience and knowledge to back up his opinions. All that at the bottom of the hour. Chris Kimball on the Good Food Hour. I'm Steve Gardner along with Chef John Ash in the KSRO kitchen.
Petaluma hears FM News Talk KSRO on Crystal Clear FM at 94.5.
Here's Chapter 6 in the history of Montgomery Village, KSRO's Michael O'Shea.
In 1950, war veteran Hugh Cotting had just launched his newest venture, Montgomery Village Shopping Plaza, on a 100-acre plot sitting just 40 feet away from the city boundary of Santa Rosa on Farmers Lane. The biggest problem with the center sitting in the unincorporated area just feet from Santa Rosa is he could not get city sewer service. Due to his cantankerous relationship with city officials, they refused an easement for sewer hookup for the new center. Hugh met with his business attorney, Finlaw Geary, to see how he might convince the city to grant the easement. Mr. Geary said, "Hugh, the city leaders just flat out don't like you. They're not going to budge." So, at 5 p.m. on Friday, just as the city courts closed for the weekend, Hugh Cotting hired a fleet of bulldozer operators to cut through the 40 feet of Farmers Lane and lay their own sewer line connected to the city pipes. By 8 a.m. on Monday morning, Montgomery Village had their new sewer connection. Attorney Geary knew there was a law on the city books that forbid the city from disconnecting any existing sewer lines for reasons of sanitation. In 1950, Hugh Cotting invented the term, "I will find a way or make one," and Montgomery Village was off and running. Excuse the choice of words. This is Michael O'Shea.
To hear all the stories in the history of Montgomery Village so far, go to mvshops.com and click on the History of Montgomery Village page.
The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market hopes your family is safe and healthy and extends a heartfelt thank you to all of Sonoma County for voting them Best Farmers Market. You'll find a wide selection of garden starts, savor farm fresh eggs and produce like fresh strawberries, avocados, and asparagus. Discover quality beef, pork, fresh seafood, and freshly made sausages. Multiple vendors are serving pre-made meals. Green Grocer has bacon or mushroom breakfast pockets, and Quiche and Carrie's shares a variety of handmade quiches and prepared meals, including gluten-free options. Try Little Farm's Dry Farm Potato Chips, and Mad Batter Cakery bakes gluten-free brownies, cakes, cookies, and scones. Santa Rosa's Original Certified Farmers Market at the Luther Burbank Center for the Arts is open year-round, Wednesdays and Saturdays, 8:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Thank you, Sonoma County, for voting them number one. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, where it's always fresh, local, and fun.
This Mother's Day, give Mom something to look forward to. We know you can't take her on a spa day, but you can gift her beauty certificates to be used when places start opening up. One idea? This week, Beauty and the Blade is offering certificates for 60% off their microblading services. New brows? Yes, please. Hurry, supply is limited and only available at mysonomadeals.com. Happy Mother's Day. Remember, buy now, browse later at mysonomadeals.com.
KSRO, AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
KSRO Kitchen, Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash and Michelle Marquez, who has been working with the California Artisan Cheese Council for many, many years and has launched a new way to interact with cheese lovers now that we can't just all sit down and break cheese and go to our favorite cheese tasting room.
Yes, I'm very excited to be working with the California Artisan Cheese Guild, and I do their social media and communications for them. It was very sad that we had to cancel the festival back in March, but the Guild has worked together now with California Milk Advisory Board and Real California Milk, and we're putting together this campaign called Buy CA Cheese, Buy California Cheese. So it's out on all of our social media, on the Guild website, which is CA Cheese Guild.org.
So did you start this whole, I saw that May is California Cheese Month.
No, no.
Was that you?
That was not me. Yeah. No, that's okay. From the American Cheese Society. Okay. That's their push. And it used to be actually October. They moved it to May, I think, just this past year. So an interesting way to be celebrating all of our great artisan cheesemakers. But yes, we launch this thing called Cheese Chats each Wednesday on the Cheese Guild's Instagram account. I am talking with a different California cheesemaker or one of our member cheesemakers. In fact, this last week I talked with Beehive Cheese. They're out of Utah, but they are a member of the California Artisan Cheese Guild. So it's really fun. We talk with the cheesemaker. We taste through a couple of their cheeses. We announce these in advance so that our fans can hear about what's happening, buy the cheeses in advance, and actually taste through with us along while we're talking with the cheesemaker. They can interact, ask questions, find out the inspiration behind the different cheeses, find out where to buy the cheeses, find out what the cheesemakers are doing in COVID-19 times and how they're pivoting and taking care of their animals, if they raise their own animals and milk their own animals, or if what they have to do to make sure that maybe milk from a nearby dairy doesn't go to waste. So there's a lot of really interesting things that we're learning with our cheesemakers.
So do you talk about how to cook with cheese? Does that become an important?
I have talked about recipes a little bit, but that's another aspect that we can talk about, of course. And mostly we're just talking about the cheese itself and the qualities of it. Yeah. Yeah.
What time are these cheese chats?
We do them on Wednesdays at 5 o'clock Pacific time. They happen on the Instagram page for the Cheese Guild, which is CA Cheese Guild. So if you go to Instagram and you look up CA Cheese Guild, you'll find them. But we have a bunch of them coming up. This week, we're going to be talking with Pedroso Dairy and Cheese out of Orland. And they are just fantastic. They made a cheese that's right here in front of you. I brought in some to try. And oh my gosh, you guys, it's so exciting when I get boxes of cheese at my house. It's so amazing.
So which cheese is this?
This is the Black Butte Reserve. So it is an aged cheese, cow's milk, and just absolutely delicious. And that's one of the cheeses that we'll be trying this Wednesday with Tom Pedroso of the Pedroso family. A lot of these cheesemakers, it's a family business, right? And so to have this kind of economic impact happen to multiple members of the family, right? Because everyone's invested in this. That's really hard. Like, sort of in your normal family, you're thinking, oh, well, this person works at this place and this person works at this other place. So if one of you is impacted financially, maybe you're going to struggle and, make different ends meet. But when it's an entire family business and this kind of thing happens, it's so hard.
So how are the cheese producers doing right now? Can you comment on that?
I don't know if I can. I know that the Cheese Guild is in contact. Our executive director, Anthea, is in contact with our cheesemakers all the time. We've got another board meeting coming up this next Monday to sort of take a temperature, as it were, about what's going on. A lot of them have been able to pivot very quickly to do shipping, which they hadn't necessarily been able to do. So that's been, have to build an online platform, right, immediately in order to sell your cheeses, figure out how do you do your inventory behind the scenes, how do you build a shipping department if you haven't had one before. So, but they're very resilient and really coming up with different ways to help their company, but also help the community. Like Beehive Cheese, who I talked with this past Wednesday, they did this thing called Project Promontory. Promontory is their base cheese that all their other cheeses are based off of. And they put up an Indiegogo campaign and raised money to employ their staff to make more cheese, keep milk from being dumped and wasted by their partner dairy, and then they're donating at cost to the local food bank. So they're feeding people with this extra cheese and employing their workers. I mean, it's just a brilliant idea. And I know that Bellwether here locally has donated yogurt and cheese to their food bank, and all of our cheesemakers are really just trying to figure out how to take care of their employees, make cheese available, not lose all of this beautiful fresh cheese, because it's springtime, right? This is the time when this fresh cheese cheeses are just amazing. And people, you know, when they're at the grocery store, they need to remember, buy those fresh cheeses. They're
so
a treat.
So how can people get some Pedrozzo cheese in anticipation of your Wednesday chat with the cheesemaker?
Yes. Well, the easiest way to make sure that you have all of the cheeses as we go forward through May with our cheese chats is to go to cacheese.org, cacheeseguild.org, cacheeseguild.org. That is the guild's website. We have a full list of them. We also have links to all of our cheesemakers, so you can go to their websites and buy their cheeses.
Can I tell you something? I just took a bite of this cheese that you brought.
Yes.
You brought. It's fantastic. I mean, it's really good. Often you have to work a little bit to get to the flavor of the cheese. This one just hits you right in the face in a good way.
It's beautiful. I'm so excited, too. They sent me some rosé, a can of beer, a lager beer, and some cider. So we're going to be tasting those things along with the cheese as well. I think it's going to be really fun.
That sounds fabulous. And this is going to be the Pedrozzo Dairy and Cheese Company that you'll be talking with, Michelle, this coming Wednesday. Is that correct?
Exactly. That'll be May 13th, coming up on May 20th, Point Reyes, and May 27th, Laura Chanel and Marin French.
That's fabulous. And Pedrozzo's out of Orland, which is in the Sacramento Valley, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, thank you. And thanks for bringing this spectacular cheese.
You're welcome.
John gives it the seal of approval.
Great. I'll let them know.
Okay. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you. I
appreciate that. KSRO News Time is 11:31, and we're going to chat with Chris Kimball right after these messages, so don't go away.
Join the switch to crystal clear KSRO FM, 103.5 Santa Rosa, Windsor, 94.5 Petaluma. Hear the difference.
Edward Philune and the team at the Center for Spiritual Living is here for you as we navigate these times. The Center for Spiritual Living in Santa Rosa invites you to visit their website for additional spiritual support. Sunday services are now live streamed at 8:30, 10, and 11:30. You can attend Wednesday evening meditations from home via Zoom. Take advantage of the telephone prayer ministry and more. Go to cslsr.org for more information on all of this. You'll also find videos of Sunday messages and resources, such as an online affirmative prayer library covering a variety of subjects. That's cslsr.org. For over 10 years, you've heard the popular Sunday morning program Spiritual Living with Edward Philune, a half hour of practical inspiration at 8:30 a.m. right here on KSRO. We're committed to continue to bring this to you and help bring the community together with messages of hope and spiritual support.
There's no doubt that this Mother's Day, the mom in your life deserves extra appreciation. A special gift from one of her favorite Montgomery Village shops is only a call, email, or click away. Create a spa-like escape for your mom with a set of luxurious Sephora bath linens from Prima Linens. Sincerely Yours has beautiful hibiscus hand-blown Italian glass vases by Vietri. The classic duck is your go-to for jewelry from Uno di 50 and Brighton. Of course, a Zen Nail Salon gift certificate for a well-deserved spa manicure or pedicure may be just what mom will want. But wait, if mom loves the garden, then how about fairy lanterns, wind spinners, or river pottery from Urban Garden? For this unique Mother's Day, let the amazing shops at Montgomery Village help you celebrate mom with a truly memorable gift. Visit mvshops.com for all the Mother's Day shopping and dining details. Montgomery Village, Highway 12 at Farmers Lane in Santa Rosa.
Mosquito prevention begins with you. Checking your yard now and removing items holding water can help to prevent mosquitoes from being a problem in the future. Rinse out plant saucers and bird baths once a week. Keep rain barrels tightly screened and dump out containers holding water. If you begin experiencing a mosquito problem, contact the Marin-Sonoma Mosquito and Vector Control District for help. 707-285-2200 or request service online at msmosquito.org. That's msmosquito.org.
At Tri-Counties Bank, their mission is to improve the financial success and well-being of our communities through a unique brand of service with solutions. They salute the healthcare professionals, first responders, and essential employees who are working so hard to keep Sonoma County safe. Their display of selflessness is truly service with solutions in action. The Santa Rosa branch at 819 4th Street is open and there to help you. Visit tricountiesbank.com or call 707-522-5480. Member FDIC.
with Sonoma County's most accurate, most dependable forecast. Here's Daniel Trucios on the KSRO Weather Watch.
Temps cooler for the weekend. Today, partly cloudy at 76, 63 on the coast. Mostly cloudy tonight, low 48, 47 on the shores. Mostly cloudy morning for Sunday with afternoon sun at 70 degrees, 60 along the coast. Monday, cloudy with rain up to a quarter of an inch, high of 64. Depend on weather every 30 minutes on FM News Talk 103.5 and 94.5 KSRO.
In the KSRO kitchen, Steve Garner along with Chef John Ash, and a gentleman who we have not had the pleasure of speaking with for, I guess it's been about 10 or 12 years, and that's Christopher Kimball, when Chris visited us in Santa Rosa when he was still affiliated with the Cooks Illustrated family. But Chris has a new family now called Milk Street, and he has a few cookbooks out and a few magazines out and a television series out, and we thought it's high time for us to catch up on what Chris Kimball has been up to over these many years. Hi, Chris, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Pleasure talking with you. It's funny because I was looking at the New York Times. There's no need for recipes now that Sam Sifton wrote on March 25th, stating it's the new way to cook without recipes, with only ingredients and a running idea of how you might use them, particularly if you cook a lot. Cooking this way is the translation of ideas into action. Because it's inexact, it rewards your personality. Particularly, it results in foods that's inescapably yours. But you've made your career on refining recipes. Is the times we live in a little bit different now, where we should just try to cook intuitively instead of looking to recipes?
Well, I just spoke to Sam. I'm sure Sam uses recipes too. I'm sure he improvises sometimes, but I'm sure Sam uses recipes. Well, if you go back 100 years, not even that long, people had a very small repertoire of recipes, right? Maybe 50 recipes or 25 or some number under 100. So you made the same breads in the same pot roast and the same pasta dishes over and over again. And that's why those people didn't need recipes, because they made them 100 times each, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of us have made pancakes hundreds of times, or baking powder biscuits, or a simple soup, or simple pesto, or a simple custard. If you make it enough times, you won't need a recipe, and then you can start improvising. But the idea that you can just stand at the stove with a new recipe, let's say you want to make a curry from Bombay, that's just not going to work out, because there's a lot to know. But if you grew up like Nick Sharma did, who's a wonderful cook, moved here for college from Bombay, he's lived that recipe. So it just depends on your familiarity with it. I think improvising with something you know nothing about is a recipe for disaster. But, no pun intended, but if you've made something dozens of times, that's when you can go from rote to being creative.
So are you, I think I've heard you say this, and if you haven't, I'll ask you the question, that everybody should have some go-to recipes, things that they can really do without thinking about it, rather than getting caught up in trying to do the latest culinary trend or trick or hack or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know if it's either or. I think absolutely the core of your cooking should be things that you understand. You know, Julia Child once told me it's 2 eggs per cup of milk for a custard, for example. I mean, those little rules are very helpful. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that you don't want to make a Singapore noodles, you know, or you want to make Oaxacan black beans or a mollete, a sort of a breakfast sandwich. I mean, sure, that's fine too. I don't think it's either or, but absolutely, every time you go in the kitchen, don't do something new. Make sure you have a foundation, and then once you have the foundation, then you can do all sorts of things. But I think the kitchen's, you know, it's like life. You know, there are no rules. You know, as Aristotle and then Julia Child once said, you know, all things in moderation, including moderation. Mm-hmm. So you can have all the rules you want, but once in a while you just want to kick back and do something new, and that's fine. But yes, a core repertoire is really critical.
So in your book, The New Rules, which I really liked a great deal, you have about three or four pages of just tips about changing the way you cook. And I think if people didn't read anything else of yours, that would be the go-to thing. Because what they are very simple things that I think often people don't think about when they're cooking. One of them was, hold the herbs until the end, before you throw them into something. And I think so often we're so hooked on trying to throw everything into the pot or the pan at one time and cook the damn thing, get it done, and get it on the table.
Yeah, before you serve a soup or a stew, there are lots of things you can do. First of all, you should taste it, right? I mean, most people, there's a lot of work that goes in the last 2 minutes to adjust salt level, the sweetness level, the sourness level, the heat level. You can add, fresh ginger or garlic at the end, or vinegar, or pomegranate molasses, or fresh herbs, or any number of things. In a lot of places in the world, they'll add some herbs at the beginning, and then they'll add the same herbs but fresh at the end. Mm-hmm. So you get a very different flavor. I was in Mexico in January when I could still travel, and I was cooking with a local chef out in the country, and he, his sofrito, which are tomatoes and onions and peppers, et cetera, he cooked those after the beans were ready. It took about 2.5 hours to cook the beans. He added that sofrito, those sautéed vegetables, at the end into the beans. And I said, why did you do that? He said, well, if I added at the beginning, after 2.5 hours of cooking, you wouldn't taste the onion. You wouldn't taste the tomato. You wouldn't taste the chilies. So that's just a little new rule, right? Add a sofrito at the end, and then all those fresh flavors are still there. So another one I love in the book is you don't have to saute meat for a stew. In fact, if you think about it, if you have 4 or 5 pounds of meat, you hardly need more umami, more meat flavor. So you add just a little bit of liquid, cook for 1.5 or 2 hours at the top on the oven, take the top off and finish cooking with the top off, and that meat is going to be exposed to the heat of the oven and will brown beautifully. So, you've probably done the same thing. You spend 25 minutes sauteing meat in batches.
Yeah.
And splatters all over, and it's just a mess. It's one reason you hate making a stew. You don't need to do that. So all the rules I grew up with for Northern European cooking, which is what I grew up with, those made sense for a time and a place. I think what we're saying now is, look, there's millions of people around the world who cook very differently than we do. Let's learn from them. And very often, they have better, simpler solutions.
You also mentioned that you don't need to cook your pasta in gallons of water. That was another new rule. And also, forget about marinating. It really doesn't work. Could you elaborate a little bit on those?
Yeah. Sure. I remember years ago, I was in Italy in a small village, hilltop village, and they were cooking the pasta in these huge pots. And then I started thinking about it, and they were making like 200 or 300 portions over the course of lunch. So there's a ton of starch in that water. At home, if you start with a big pot of water and you cook 1 pound of pasta or 1/2 pound of pasta, you don't get a lot of starch in the water. And so by using less water, it's starchier. And starchy water is the basis for your sauce. The Italians almost never put sauce on top of cooked pasta. They undercook the pasta. They put the pasta with the sauce in a skillet. They add some of the cooking liquid, which is starchy, which helps bind the sauce to the pasta. So that's a great technique. What was the other one you mentioned?
About marinating.
Oh, marinating, yeah. Well, everyone I think knows has done this. Marinades get in about 1/4 inch deep, which if it's a chicken cutlet is okay, but it's not if it's a pork shoulder. The only thing that gets in a marinade is the salt. And for a bunch of reasons, electrical charges and some other things, the salt will go in. But the organic compounds, like spices, shallots, onions, garlic, those don't go in, at least not in a sufficient amount to flavor the meat. So the best thing to do with a marinade is just to cook the food and then put it in the marinade before serving. Mm. which will flavor the outside. But the interior of meat will never get flavored by a marinade. The salt will get in, but nothing else.
I was just going to ask about your epiphany with using baking soda in all different applications.
Yeah, baking soda, well, if you're baking, you use baking soda, which is alkaline, non-acidic, to balance out acidic ingredients. So if you have brown sugar or buttermilk or something like that, which is acidic, the baking soda balances it. In savory cooking like beans, for example, it will help soften the exterior of the bean, so the beans cook thoroughly, and they also cook evenly. Because every time you cook beans, unless you do that, unless you soak them ahead of time overnight, you find some beans are cooked and some beans are not. So for even cooking, a little bit of baking soda is really helpful.
So, Chris, can you give us a Cliff Notes version of how you came to cooking? What triggered all of this? When did you start cooking? Did you always cook?
Yeah, I was 8 or 9. I think it was a Fanny Farmer book, and I made a chocolate cake with a 7-minute frosting. Well, a 7-minute frosting is really tricky. And so the cake came out pretty well, but the frosting turned out like snot. I mean, it really did look just like, it was awful. It was supposed to be billowy and thick, and it was just awful. And my parents, and this is a good lesson for parents, told me how great it was. And so I was really encouraged to go on. I always liked baking. So there are times when lying to your children is absolutely the right thing to do, to give them encouragement. And so I just started with that. And then I spent a lot of time in Vermont on a farm and summers and weekends. And I spent time at a farmhouse where there was a baker, a woman, Marie Briggs. And on a rainy day when I wasn't out paying or something, she would teach me to bake. And she had a wood stove, green Kalamazoo wood stove, and she baked bread in it. She baked cookies and pies and everything else, and she had a pump in the sink, and there was no indoor plumbing. And I learned, and she cooked for the farmers, and she also sold her baked goods. So she taught me a lot about baking, and I tell a story about how Vermonters teach you. She would never tell me what to do. But if I was doing it wrong, which I was most of the time, she would stand next to me and do it right. And she wouldn't even look at me. She'd disappear. And so I was supposed to be smart enough to realize that she was giving me a lesson, a cooking lesson, which is very different than the other cooking lessons I've had later in life.
The New Rules is the book we're talking to Chris Kimball about right now. And congratulations, Chris. We just saw that the James Beard nominated that book for a cookbook award this week, and it'll be a while before the cookbook awards, that's being changed fall, but congratulations on that. The other book that just came out is a book called Fast and Slow, and I was surprised to see you endorsing and
the Instapot.
it threw me for a loop. You're not a guy that I think of as jumping on the bandwagon for any type of appliance.
I was surprised, too, because the idea came up in the office, and I said, well, why are we doing that? So we did a bunch of recipes just to see. And I was, you know, I've used pressure cookers, I've used slow cookers, and et cetera. But I was surprised. I found two things I liked. I liked the fact that it organizes your cooking. That is, you know, once it goes in the pot and you crank it up and it's done, essentially. So it forces you to do that. The other thing I found I liked about it was you're not staying there trying to figure out when something's done because it's timed. So I just thought if the food was good, the convenience of it and the way it forces you to organize your cooking schedule were big pluses. And then we started cooking with it. And I got to tell you, the food, look, there are plenty of times I would prefer to have a skillet, right, and cook, and I just like that process. I like to smell the food. Like to see the food, I like to taste the food as I cook it. But there are a lot of things. Beans, obviously, you know, risotto does really well. We even made some pasta dishes in it, which sounds ridiculous because it's not faster by the time you get things up to pressure and let it cool, but let the pressure come down. But it does get the sauce into the pasta, which I thought was really great. it's great for big cuts of meat. I know in the last 2 months, I've cooked a lot of pork shoulders in an Instant Pot in about 45 minutes. And then I have shredded pork, and I can use it for a dozen different things. So beans, black beans, I do in an Instant Pot on a Sunday, and then I have them the rest of the week. So it's like everything else, you know. I don't do all my cooking in it. I do some of my cooking in it when it makes sense. But since you can saute in it, since it is a pressure cooker and it is also a slow cooker, you know, it does enough stuff so it will stick around in my kitchen. My pressure cooker, my slow cookers, those are all in the basement because I just didn't have enough use for them. Mm-hmm. But this is something I will use. It's, you know, it's not every day, but it does a good job. And I was shocked, you know, to be honest. I just didn't think I would like it. But, you know, I think you have to be. And Julia Child, I remember years ago, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, she called me over and because she wanted to use a bread machine to see if it would work. And she was always curious about new stuff, you know. She wouldn't reject it because Escoffier wouldn't have used it. And I think that's the same attitude everyone should have. You know, give it a shot. I mean, I personally wouldn't use a bread machine. But the Instant Pot, it does enough stuff, and it does a good job. So I'm a fan.
And you tested this in a standard 6-quart pressure cooker, Instant Pot cooker, correct?
Yeah, and you know, it'll cost, you know, $100 or whatever. They're reasonable, but they really do. Look, I've always been an advocate of helping people get dinner on the table through home cooking, right? So I'm not an elitist about this, you know. So anything that's going to help people cook from scratch for their family is a yes for me, and as long as it's really useful. And it's not just a silly gadget. So I would say this definitely qualifies as pretty useful. As I said, it's an organizational tool. It forces you to get everything done by the time it goes in the pot. You're not sitting there for 4 hours, you know, chopping onions in hour three, you know, and measuring mm-hmm. the spices in hour two. It gets done, gets in the pot. When it comes out of the pot, it's done.
So with the Instant Pot, do you have a favorite recipe? That's probably a silly thing to ask, but is there something that this is the best version of X I've ever had?
Yeah, I would say three things. I would say for cooking shoulder, beef or pork, it does a great job and does it quickly, and it's just a great starting point. If you go to Mexico, everybody has a pressure cooker, and when they do anything with pork, they always start with a pressure cooker. They cook the pork unseasoned, and then they finish cooking the pork in a number of ways. So I would say that would be one. Two, beans, yes, absolutely. Black beans, any kind of beans, they do a great job in the pressure cooker. And I think also there are times when there's a chicken dish in there with tomatoes, which is really interesting because it melds the flavors together in a nice way. I mean, I think the key with the Instant Pot is having big flavors going in, because sometimes in a pressure cooking you tend to mute flavors. So if you start with big flavors going in, with a lot of spices, whole spices, etc., the pressure cooker or the Instant Pot does a very good job of combining those flavors nicely in a fairly low amount of time. The one other thing I just tried this morning was I hard-cooked eggs in it, couple water, put the eggs on a simmer basket inside, 8 minutes on low, take them out, let them sit for 2 minutes, and then throw them in ice water. It actually did get the shell off pretty well. So that's one of those ongoing things 100 years from now people would be arguing about on social media. But, and nothing's foolproof, but it did a pretty good job. So that's a little trick.
So I just, because it was in your other book, The New Rules, that I think most people don't know about, is you recommend steaming eggs in the shell rather than boiling them in water.
Yeah. Yeah, the reason is when you steam has a lot of energy. So to get those water molecules to become steam, that you need to put a bunch of heat, that is energy, into them. So the thing about steaming that's nice, which means half an inch of water at the bottom of the pot, you don't need a steamer basket. You can put one egg in or six eggs in, and the time will still be the same. I do 6.5 minutes for my breakfast eggs. Whereas in water, if you have more eggs or fewer eggs, it does change the timing. So I do find steaming is better. And I think for peeling, steaming does a little bit better than boiling in terms of throwing it into ice water and then peeling. But the best thing is it keeps, it doesn't change your time because steam has a lot more energy in it than water does.
So what's the next book?
The next book comes out in the fall, which I'm really excited about. It's called Cookish. And we spoke earlier about, you know, not needing a recipe. These are very simple recipes, like six ingredients plus oil and salt and pepper, et cetera. Mostly six ingredients. And they're designed so that once you make it, you could probably make it again without following the recipe. Mm-hmm. And this is our attempt to come to recipes that have that are natural, you know, obviously homemade, you know, no artificial ingredients or processed foods in them, but they have big flavors and they're fresh and they're simple. And it was the hardest book we've ever done because that's a hard thing to do well. But it's everybody's goal, right, in cooking is to mm-hmm. get to the point where you don't need a lot of ingredients. Look, if you got 20 ingredients in a stew, you really can't go wrong. I mean, you can, but it's hard. With six ingredients, you know, it's got to be just the right ingredients and the right combination. So these are short ingredient lists, short directions, fairly quick cooking, but they're big flavors. And it's really based on our travels because most of the world starts with lots of herbs, lots of spices, lots of, you know, fermented sauces like soy sauce or fish sauce, chilies, other ingredients, lemongrass, you know, ginger. So if you have those ingredients in your pantry, and most people do, you can turn out really good food pretty simply. And that's the one thing that struck me from the last few years at Milk Street is the simplicity of the cooking around the world. It's not always simple, but most of the time it is, because everyone's putting dinner on the table. But I think in general, most people around the world have a very good solution to that. And the question is, how do you think about flavor combinations?
And I'm looking at Milk Street Magazine, one of the latest issues, the May June one. Italy zucchini pancetta pasta, Mumbai's chicken vindaloo, Spain's paprika shrimp. A different direction than mm-hmm. where you were with Cook's Illustrated. This appears to you have a much greater focus, I think, on it appears Middle Eastern, Mediterranean, and Asian spices and seasonings and techniques in this new venture. Is that accurate, possibly?
Yeah, I got to the point a few years ago where I started traveling, and I realized that, you know, my aha moment was it's not ethnic cooking, which is a term I don't like very much. You know, everyone's just cooking, right? And so if you get away from this idea that this is a Saturday night special dinner, you know, a Moroccan dinner or something, like we did back in the 70s when everybody was doing those things, was cooking, and just say, well, everyone's just cooking, and so let's learn and figure out what they're doing. And once I got over that hurdle, I became very comfortable in someone else's kitchen. For example, I was in Beirut a year ago. I was in someone's kitchen. In fact,
oops, looks like we just lost Chris.
Oh, no.
Are you there, Chris? No. Okay.
Okay.
Well, I'm afraid Chris is gone. maybe Chris is calling back. Well, yeah. Give him a couple seconds.
Okay.
Your technology is great, as we know. Instant pots are great when they work. But when your power goes out or something's lost, then we're kind of, let's see. We're not sure.
Yeah.
No. Okay. We don't have him. I'm sorry.
Well, he was great.
Yeah. And thank you, Chris, for joining us. And hopefully we'll get back in touch with you in fall for your new cookbook.
For the new cookbook, which is very exciting. The simple six-ingredient kind of recipes are fantastic.
And the new books we talked about were The Milk Street Fast and Slow, that's the Instant Pot Cooking, and The New Rules. Well, I'll tell you what, John, we could give away a copy of
them. Sure.
Which one do you want to do?
I don't know. Let's do Fast and Slow because it convinced him to love the Instapot after not loving it.
And caller number what?
How about caller number five?
Caller number five at 636-1350 will win this brand new book, and it's been out about a month. Milk Street, Fast and Slow, Instant Pot Cooking at the Speed You Need by Christopher Kimball, founder of Milk Street, the television show, the magazines, the cookbooks.
The radio show.
The radio show. It's remarkable. Yeah. Caller number, did you say six?
Five.
Call number five at 636-1350. We'll win this copy of Fast and Slow, and we'll send it out to you. Next week, we're going to be celebrating National Barbecue Day.
Oh, is it next week?
It's next Saturday. We'll be doing that next week. How about that? And we'll talk barbecue, and we'll make barbecue, and we'll talk to some barbecue experts.
Okay.
All that coming up next week. Michelle Marquess updates news in just a couple minutes.
News, traffic, weather, talk. Sonoma County's News Talk.